got from CNN on my telephone, another suicide bombing in Kabul. We don't know what to make of the current situation. We don't know what to make of the current world. In particular, we do not know what to make of the relationship between Judaism and Islam. But there are people who do know about those things, and there are people who make intensive studies, dedicate their careers, whether they are working as Professor Firestone at the University of Southern California, Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, or people who are working here in the Netherlands, either at academic level, so as Professor Frischmann, who is sitting here, and others, the University of Amsterdam, she's at Leiden University. There is a diversity of people involved. There are also all of us who are involved with organizations within the liberal Jewish community. Because one of the things that is clear in our responsibilities as members of a liberal or progressive Jewish community is to be concerned with a world that is not just our own internal world, but a world that surrounds us, and to be involved in that world. And that's why it's so important that these kinds of presentations, as we are going to have today, are being made. It's also an integral part of the curriculum for our educational program for rabbis, that they look outside just the core of Judaism to see how it interfaces with other aspects of religions in the world. This is something we started from the day that the Rabbi Nachum Leiden started a number of years ago. So the seminar that we're having today is not just an isolated seminar, it's also part of a curriculum of lectures that we've been given, which I believe started yesterday and they're going on today. I think things happen Mondays. In any case, there are 4 days of lectures that are being given on this particular topic, but today we have a special treat of having a lecture from the world expert. Among other things, and the easiest way to find out what Professor Firestone has done is, of course, to just do what I do. You go to Google, and you Google his name, and then you go to his official biography, which can also be downloaded in PDF form so that you don't have to do any work. But the point is, he has extensive experience in this field. He is the author of this book, which has been more than warmly recommended by Rabbi Lilienthal, An Introduction to Islam for Jews, which, if you want to talk about the sense of good journalism, discusses the who, the what, the why, the where, and the how. These are all important aspects that you want to have. What is the relationship? Where does it come from? Where is it going? How did it get that way? These are the kinds of elements that are discussed in this book. And I recommend it to all of you as an opportunity to follow on the things that are going to be presented and discussed today. Now, in terms of that presentation, first, Reuben, you're going to give a presentation of a certain number of minutes, then there's going to be a pause, as I understand it.
If
necessary.
People want another cup of coffee.
Yeah, people want another cup of coffee, then we'll have a second part, and then after that, there'll be the opportunity to ask questions. I will leave it to you, Reuben, to decide, would you rather have questions during the course of your presentation, or would you rather save them up for the end? Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah. Questions at the end, otherwise this thing can go on, and we won't leave it until 8 o'clock tonight. And why that would be pleasant, I don't think it's the intention. So first we'll have the presentations, then we'll have the opportunity for everyone in the audience to ask questions. Okay, so without any further words from me, I'd like to introduce Professor Reuben Firestone.
Thank you very much. I just realized I can understand Dutch. It was so easy for me to understand everything he said. And so thank you for, maybe it was the accent that made it more distinguishable. I'm not sure. So I'm going to change everything around from what was just told to you. I apologize. But what I would like you to do right now, if you have, is to take out a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper, if you don't already. And you have to take notes for the exam at the end. So that's number one. And number two, more important than that, I would like you to take a moment as I begin my discussion. Nothing I say at this point is important. I want you to write down questions you have that you would like to have answered if you had a perfect world and you had an expert who were able to do this. I'm not telling you that I am that person. I would like you to write down the question, the most important question you have about Jewish-Muslim relations, because that is the topic of the discussion today. And with that, I will kind of reformulate my discussion to try to respond to the questions that you have. I have enough experience in this business to know that a lecturer could give a phenomenally, exceptionally good lecture and not deal with the issues that you want to deal with. My purpose being here today is not for me to hear myself speak, but to try to respond to the issues that are most important to you. So I will know that better if I hear from you. I'm not Dutch, I'm not European, and so I don't have that kind of sensitivity to the issues that are particular to this environment, and I'd like to be able to respond to them. So I hope you're doing that. You can do that now, and I'll tell you a story or two. This is not a question, this is something else, right? Oh, I want you to write the question rather than to ask it, if you don't mind. And then I'll collect them, take a quick look at them, and then be able to respond. So think about it. As you do this, I want to tell you where I'm coming from. I was asked to speak slowly because not everyone is completely comfortable in my very quick spoken English. I tend to speak quickly, too quickly sometimes, and I will try not to today. But I want you to know that I am approaching the topic, you know, something about me. I'm a Jew, committed, a Zionist, committed. I'm an American, very much in the Western tradition. Scholarship and worldview, committed to that as well. I'm very happy to be Western. I'm happy to be Jewish. Even happy to be American, despite the fact that I have some ambivalent feelings sometimes about that. But that's not where I'm coming from today. That is, I am not speaking as a Jew today, although I am a Jew. I'm not speaking as a Westerner today, although I am a Westerner. I'm trying to understand Islam by getting out of my own personal history and my own personal identity to look at the relationship between Jews and Muslims and the phenomenological relationship between the religions of Judaism and Islam, which of course must include Christianity too, because it's a tripartite relationship. It's not just two in the room. And I am going to say things, inevitably, that will be upsetting to people in the room, because I'm not going to confirm for you any especially good feelings that you have about your identity as a Jew or as a Westerner, as a whatever. That's not my job. My job is to do the best I can to try to understand a phenomenon that I'm looking at in as an objective manner as possible, to try to get out of my own head, if you will, to do the work. And I always, in this kind of forum, in all forums, I try to live up to the approach of a colleague of mine, who's a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Utah, Ibrahim Karawan, an Egyptian-American professor who teaches Middle East political science. And he always says this following little note. When he addresses his first class of undergraduate students, the introduction to Middle East political science, he says something like this. He says, I assume you come to the class, like so many other students have told me they come to the class, because the Middle East is such a complicated and crazy situation. You come here so you can speak to an expert who can simplify things for you and make it understandable. My job, if I want to make it understandable, is not to simplify things, but to complexify things. Because the world is very complex, and anyone who tells you the answer is simple, you have to be very careful about that message. Because the answer is, if it was simple, it would have been resolved many, many years ago. It tends to be extremely complex. And my job here today is to complexify things. So if you don't have satisfaction that we've resolved all the issues and we know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, then you're in good company. All right, so can anyone want to give me some of these questions? Or perhaps I can get some help with this and then we'll respond. I do have an agenda, but I have an idea of what I want to cover, but I want to make sure. Okay, so... So I'll mix these up. But some of these are personal confessions. So I thank you. All right, I'll start reading them. Okay, just start reading them, and we'll put these all on the agendas, if you will. Okay. Why has there been no real improvement over 60 years in relations between Israel and the Muslim world? Okay. Do American Jewish men admire Ayaan Hirsi Ali because she gives them ammunition against Islam? Personally, I feel we are too afraid of Islam, that a European form of Islam is developing. How do you see this? How does the Muslim religion consider Jews and Judaism? Can there be peace? How can we as individuals further better relations between Arabs and Jews and peace and safety for Israel? How to approach Muslims when they don't accept other religions? Unless that's a shopping list. Wrong piece of paper.
Yeah.
I own coffee.
Yeah. How? How to get Jews who distrust most dialogue and Muslims to do dialogue with Muslims who consider most Jews to be Zionist oppressors? What does the Quran I think have to say in the often why does the Quran often seem negative, I think, or that there are maybe Islamic or Quranic negative views of Jews and Judaism, perhaps that might be it. And is Islam's criticism based on anti-Zionism, anti-Judaism, anti-Israeli politics? Can we distinguish between them in Islamic discourse? We're almost done. We'll have to sign up for the whole. If Israel is afraid of Islam spreading in Europe, is this reasonable? The approach to texts and hermeneutics is so different between Jews and Muslims. How to talk about that? Do you see any way in which one religious group, Muslims or Jews, etc., could mediate in the most conflictive relations between the two? To what extent is Islam one religion? So different groups have different ideas. So many different, or do different groups have different ideas about the world, Jewish-Muslim relations, etc.? You are happy to be American. Yes, you are happy to be American, but you could be something in Israel. Is there no simple explanation? I'm sorry, I don't understand the handwriting. Go somewhere? No. I'm not sure if I get this one. What can I do to get closer to Muslims but try to keep Israel out of the discussion? No politics. My feeling as a Jew is that we are more similar to Muslims culturally, family relations, music, etc., dietary rules, than we are to Christians, but do they feel the same way?
You are happy to be an American, but you would also be happy to be in Israel.
Okay. No simple explanation? What then, I think?
Yes.
Okay. Complexify. Art is a way to simplify. Complexity is a good way. What do you say about that? Do Muslims traditionally see Jews as their enemies? Don't you think that the fact that Muslims consider the Quran as the completion, or better said, the ultimate better version of the Torah Bible, is the reason that relations will be forever disturbed? That thought is very hard, but that conviction is very difficult. think that gives me a sense of where the community is. That fair sense of where the community is coming from. So let's talk a little bit. You're really interested in contemporary issues. You're not, as a whole, from what I hear from the questions, you really want to see how Jewish-Muslim relations have created or developed to the point where we are today. That's really what you're really interested in, is the contemporary scene and the history or longitudinal movement of Jewish-Muslim relations, in as much as they impact the way Jews and Muslims relate today on an individual level, on a group level, religiously, politically, and nationally. That makes sense, I think. That's my sense of how things go. So, luckily, I'm not a modernist. My field is not modern history, modern political science, so therefore I can't answer any of your questions. My field is pre-modern, medieval studies, and study of religion. But the good news is that I work on topics that are very deeply informative of the way religious people and national people look at themselves and in their relationship to the world at large. So what I look at in my research is not only history of like political relations, but I've written on the notion of holy war in Islam and Judaism, and I have written on the notion of shared tradition, that is textual tradition, biblical tradition, interpretive traditions between the various communities, and I'm working on other phenomenology, like on the issue of chosenness or divine election, as it is articulated in Judaism and in Christianity and in Islam. And these are religious concepts and cultural concepts that have a very strong impact on the way people view the world around them, and our traditional texts tell us something about how we should live as human beings beyond our identity within the religious tradition. So a notion of chosenness, for example, or a notion of when it is acceptable or not acceptable or preferable to go to war on behalf of God or religion, these are issues that really do affect the way people relate to one another today. So I think it's okay for me to, to try to respond to these questions. First off, I'll tell you something you already know, and that is that there is no such thing as Islam, and there's no such thing as Judaism. And today, we don't even use terms sometimes when we're in dealing in the academic world. We say Christianities, or Judaisms, or Islams, because it's very easy to make the facile mistake of assuming everybody's the same. Now, we all know whatever religion we belong to or whatever national community we belong to, we already know intimately how varied our community is. People who are on the liberal end of the spectrum, people on the reactionary end of the spectrum, people in the middle, and they're all spread out in terms of religious practice, in terms of religious ideology, in terms of a sense of history and relatedness to other people outside of the religious community, for example. We know this about our own community, but when we look at other communities, we have a tendency to do what all humans do all the time, and we must do this, and in fact, we are almost certainly genetically programmed to do this. We tend to put people in categories and in big chunks, and we're taught in the liberal world that we should judge an individual for that person's self, you know, not put them in categories. But our brain is training us, our family is training us too, since we're infants, to do exactly the opposite. When you walk down the street at night, you want to know who that person is who's coming toward you. You identify them by gender, you identify them by race, you identify them by culture, because you need to do that for your own protection, and this is all very intuitive. We're doing this all the time, not just when we're walking down the street late at night. We do it all the time, because otherwise the world would be impossible for us to navigate. It would just be too complex. So on the one hand, we have to do that. On the other hand, intellectually, we're trained or we're told we shouldn't do that because we need to, right? And that's part of the difficulty of negotiating and navigating a complex world. So we need to, when you say Muslims, because some of these questions were directed towards Muslims, why do Muslims think this? Why do they think that? There is no such entity as Muslims. There are different positions within the Muslim world, just as there are in the Jewish world and the Christian world. So let me just begin in the beginning, in the emergence of religion. And I'm going to tell you a story about how religions come into the world and what, when they are born, what they face. Why am I talking about this? Because it actually has a significant impact. There have always been new religions emerging into history. There have always been new prophets. There have been new religious leaders. God has spoken or revealed the divine message to different people throughout history. We have prophets in our own generation. Today, in the 21st century, we have prophets. We had a prophet yesterday who made a prophecy that didn't come true. You know this one, probably. The world was supposed to end yesterday, according to a prophecy of someone in the United States, I believe, who made a calculation based on biblical prophecies that the world should come to an end yesterday. He didn't consult with me. But then again, I have no higher authority. It didn't happen. Now, when a prophet comes today, what do we call them? A nut. A lunatic. Right? Yeah. So what's the difference between a nut and a lunatic and a prophet?
Followers.
Yeah. Whether you're able to... Followers. Are you able to attract a critical mass of people who believe your message? Now, from the perspective of the academic study of religion, it's impossible to determine whether a prophet is a true prophet or not. The Bible actually deals with the problem in Deuteronomy, in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy. God says through Moses, I will raise up a prophet from you among your own people, and you better listen to what that prophet says. Anyone who doesn't respond positively to the words of my prophet, I will hold him to account. But if a prophet comes to speak to you words that I don't say, you must kill that prophet. You must destroy the prophet. So how do you determine, and then God actually says, how do you know the difference between a true prophet and a false prophet? And the answer, as God articulates it in chapter 18 of Deuteronomy, is quite simple. If the prophet makes a prophecy that does not come to pass, the prophet is a false prophet and needs to be killed. So if you paid attention to prophecy in the Bible and in the New Testament and in the Quran, you'll notice that prophecies tend to be pretty vague. They don't do what that prophet did the other day to say that the world would end on a certain date, because you're liable to get caught and then it's the end of you. So there is a notion that God continues to give revelations, or there are people who are prophets or think themselves as prophets. Today, new religions are called what? What do we call them?
Cults.
They call them cults, or on a good day, sects. So a cult is a religion that doesn't, you know, that has no respect. Why do we call them cults? Because they're not true, right? But how do we know that they're not true? We know that the new religions are not true because we, by definition, identify with established religions. Now, these are general rules on how religions sort of function in the world, in the history of religion. All established religions in the monotheistic traditions, not in the Hindu traditions necessarily, but certainly in the monotheistic traditions that we're familiar with, all religions reach a point in their development where they decide that there can be no more scripture, there can be no more revelation. The authentic revelations are canonized into a discrete text, and then there is no more prophecy that can be accepted. From the standpoint of the academic study of religion, it's almost like an arbitrary decision. There can be no more prophets. Therefore, Jews who lived at the time of Jesus could not accept Jesus as a divine representation of God or a representation of the divine will, because it was at that period of time that the canon of the Hebrew Bible had been or was in the process of being finalized. There could be no more prophets, no more prophecy. Jews and Muslims, by definition, Jews and Christians, by definition, could not accept Muhammad's prophethood because they already had established religions. Established religions mean, from the social science perspective, it means that a religious establishment develops, a hierarchy, power structures, and people don't want to give away the store to new leaders. There's already conflict within the established religion between different sects or different communities of people that are arguing with one another over what is the true word of God. How does God want you to practice? How should you pray? How should you believe? What food should you be allowed to eat? How should you relate to other people in your community or people outside the community? These are all issues that are constantly being negotiated. And different factions within the communities argue, often on the basis of who is more authoritative in representing God's will. And arguments are made, and interpretations are given. A new prophet makes an end run around that whole argument, goes directly to God and says, I have the answer. I trump all of your arguments because God told me personally that I'm right. And so new prophets are always hated by the establishment. Luckily, for the establishment, most new prophets fail very quickly, and the new religions basically fall apart. Bickering, prophecies that don't come true, they aren't able to deliver on the promises that are given, and so they don't succeed. But whenever a new religion begins to succeed, the establishment religion begins to try to destroy it. And it's done in the beginning through rhetoric to try to convince a world of potential believers that the prophet is not a true prophet, the revelation is not a true revelation, and the religion isn't going to give you anything. But if that doesn't work, establishment religions inevitably become physical. And that happened in the emergence of Israelite religion, in the emergence of Christianity, in the emergence of Islam, and the emergence of all other religions as well. Sometimes religions are simply destroyed by the establishment, and people are killed. So there's always tension between new religious movements and establishment religions. It's a very serious topic. I have a question for you. See if you can answer this question. What is the difference between a cult and a religion? The real difference between a cult and a religion. Yes, about 100 years, they say. If you can last about 100 years, you're no longer a cult. You become a religion. Yes?
Can someone translate those words in Dutch?
And Brazil does that. And when we had a cult, Brazil is dying. 100 yards.
That's sort of a joke. But it's true. I mean, it's true. There was a cartoon once I saw in the newspaper, and it was one of these fundraisers, and it was a religious fundraiser for a new movement, and it says, "Help us achieve our goals." Right? And there was a kind of thermometer with each level of money, the numbers go up, and at the bottom it says, "Scary cult." And then it says, distasteful sect. And then it says, bad religion. And then at the top it says, religion of God. Let's say we have a new religion that's successful. Where do we know and how do we know what we learn? Or how do we know what we do know about the moments of emergence of a new religion? Where do we get the data, the information? What's the source of information that's closest to the moment of religious emergence? If I want to know something about ancient Israel, what's the ancient religion? what's the text that we have to look at, or what's the information? We can't look at the, you know, at the Post or the Times. It's Scripture, right? It's Scripture is the one item that is the closest. Because new religions usually aren't important until 100 or more years after they begin, other people aren't really interested. They don't even notice, usually, new religions. So you can't learn anything about early Christianity from outside sources. The only sources you can learn about early Christianity, the early sources, are the texts of the New Testament itself. That's the earliest we have. Same thing with the Quran. Nobody's writing about early Islam until after Islam has become established. So the Quran is the earliest text we have for that early moment. Same thing with ancient Israel. It's the text of the Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible, that is the closest to the moment of emergence. And that text tends to include within it some of the attitudes of the members of the new religious movement when they were young and when they were being opposed, in some cases persecuted, by the establishment religions. So many of us are very familiar with the New Testament texts that refer to Jews. Jews are an establishment religion at the time that Christianity emerges into history. The Jews are not very happy with another community that's becoming successful and saying, we have the truth, and our truth is better or more truthful than what you claim is the truth. And there's a lot of resentment. And the resentment doesn't come out of thin air. It's not because Christians are evil people that they don't like the Jews and that there's negativity directed toward the Jews in the New Testament. The reason is because the Jews didn't like the Christians saying, we are the true expression of God rather than you. Same thing with the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible has tremendous anger and resentment, rage directed against Canaanite religion. Because these are the establishment religions out of which the religion of ancient Israel emerged. And so, too, the Quran has negative references toward Jews, who were established religion in Arabia in the 7th century, and Christians, who were part of established religion in Arabia in the 7th century. And more of its anger is directed against pre-Islamic Arabian indigenous religion of polytheism, which represented the greatest threat to the success of this new movement of Islam into history. So when we as Jews or Christians read the text of the Quran and we see that it has negative references to Jews and Christians, and it does, we have to not just see it through our own narrative, the eyes of our establishment religion. We want to understand the phenomenology as a whole. We have to understand it for what it is. It is a reaction to attempts to discredit the Prophet or to destroy the new religion, which was seen as threatening for the established religion. Are you following me? Get it? Okay. Same thing with negative references to Judaism in the New Testament and of the negative references to pre-biblical religions also in the Hebrew Bible. Now, there is a difference, however, and that is when a Jew reads the New Testament and then sort of looks through the history of relations between Jews and Christians in the ancient and medieval world, we realize that the negative and the bad kind of treatment that Jews suffered in the medieval world was, to a significant extent, a result of Christian readings of their own scripture that justified anger or hatred or bad treatment toward Jews in history. So they actually resulted in serious problems. Today, if a Jew or a Christian reads the Quran and sees the negative references in the Quran that are being used by radical Muslims today as justification to be violent and engage in violent acts against Jews and Christians, we don't read this as a phenomenology of history. We read this as people who are angry and upset because there are people who are killing our people or directing very negative or bad policies toward our people and justifying that from references in the Quran. What we don't pay attention to, really, is the terrible, nasty references in the Hebrew Bible directed toward the Canaanites, for example. But that's because there are no Canaanites in the world to make us feel badly about all of our nasty rhetoric within our tradition, right? Okay, so in a way, you know, you can say, oh, you're an academic, big deal. Okay, so we our real world today, we have more Muslims in the world who are referring to their scripture as a justification to engage in negative behaviors against Jews and Christians than we have Christians engaging in negative behavior towards Jews. And of course, Jews can't really engage in negative behavior toward Amalekites because we don't have them anymore. We invent them, however. Jews can invent Amalekites when they need to, when we need to. Okay. Are you following me on this? All right. I hope it's giving you a little bit of help about where things are coming from. Now, if you don't have this noble academic view, and you are looking at the world through the eyes of a believer within your own religious system, you don't see the world the way I articulated it to you. You see it differently. And you tend to construct the world around you according to what we now call in the field meta-narrative. That is a kind of a worldview around you, around which we construct the world to understand who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, and of course, we're always in the good guys category, right? And we understand our place in the world, we understand how we are usually not responsible for the problem, but the problem is somehow outside of us. We need to respond to it in a way that's going to protect us, maybe deal with the problem too, but the most important thing is, of course, to protect the community that we belong to. And that could be a national meta-narrative, an ethnic meta-narrative, racial meta-narrative, or a religious meta-narrative. And I can speak as a Jew, I can say most Jews in the world today have one version or another. You know, not everybody lives in the same narrative, but we live within a school of narratives, I suppose, that identifies problems in Israel and Palestine between Israelis and Palestinians or Jews and Arabs in the Middle East according to a Jewish narrative that conveniently understands the problems in a way that balances out so that the Jews or Israelis are not as much at fault as the other side. And I can assure you that Arabs and Muslims see the same conflict from a different narrative perspective. It does virtually the same thing, but from the other perspective. You understand where I'm coming from? Okay, now, I'm not trying to simply, what sometimes people say, oh, this is moral relativism. I'm not making a moral statement about this. I'm making a phenomenological statement about how people view the world and why some conflicts seem to be intractable because we have people who are not speaking the same language, even when they're speaking technically the same language. Okay. So here we are. So now let's talk about some of the kind of thrust of history. You're probably familiar with the notion of the Golden Age. There was a, if you're Spanish, the Golden Age begins in 1492 or 1496, when first the Jews and then the Muslims were kicked out of Spain. And then Spain blossomed and grew and was so tremendously successful politically, militarily, economically for some couple of hundred years. That was the Golden Age. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the classic Golden Age when Jews and Muslims and Christians lived together in wonderful harmony in Spain and everything was lovely. Now, you're familiar with this, right? How many people say it happened? Raise your hand. How many people say it didn't happen? Raise your hand. How many people say it sort of happened? Raise your hand. Okay, that's probably the best answer. Thank you. I want to talk to you a little bit about the narrative of the Golden Age. Well, first of all, some facts, some data in general. There is no fact here. This is all historical interpretation. Just for the record, I, as a medieval historian, believe that the time in which Jews and Christians and Muslims lived together in the Spanish environment from about the 10th to the 13th centuries was really pretty good. It was about the best that there was in the medieval world. It was a time when Jews and Christians and Muslims could live under the rule of a Muslim government in which there was a lot of cultural interaction, social interaction. Jews and Christians could be wealthy, not just Muslims. They had a fair amount of freedom in general, and things were reasonably good. Not as good as they are in the modern world, where you live in a true democracy with protections and rights for minorities. In a true democratic system that's functional, that world was not anywhere nearly as good as it is today, because Christians and Jews lived as second-class people that were they were protected by law to be citizens within a Muslim government, a Muslim state, but they were protected as second-class citizens. They had rights, they could go to court, they could sue Muslims, but their witnessing in court was not as valuable as a Muslim witnessing in court. And they had restrictions on the size of houses they could live in, whether they could rebuild synagogues and churches, what kind of clothing they could wear. There were all kinds of restrictions, not the kind of world we would want today. But for the most part, and of course, even during that period of time, there were cases where there were massacres, there were cases where things were not good within that general world, because it wasn't all the same. So having said that, I just want you to know the issue there is not an issue of modernity versus medieval. Because modern doesn't mean good. The worst atrocities and the worst killings in the history of humanity that I'm aware of occurred in the modern world. When you think of Nazi fascism, or you think of Stalinist totalitarianism, the worst of the medieval world never got to that point. So the issue was not medieval versus modern. That binary division should be thrown out entirely. There were times in the medieval world where it was much better than there were times in the modern world. We're talking about a governmental system, not an age. Okay? So there was a relatively golden age, or at least golden in relation to the way, let's say, Jews were being treated in the Christian world at that time. During the period in Spain when Jews and Christians had a significant number of rights in the Spanish environment. It also happened in Baghdad, it happened in Egypt, it happened in parts of North Africa. It wasn't just Spain. In that period of time, the legal status of Jews in the Christian world was eroding to an extent that eventually the Jews would lose all of their legal status to live in the Christian world at any level. And they were not protected by law. They were protected by individual noblemen who would essentially own Jews, work them as much as they wished, throw them out when they wanted to throw them out, bring in new ones when they wanted to bring in new ones. And Jews lost their legal status within European society in general. That happened in the High Middle Ages. That was significantly worse than the problems that Jews faced, let's say, among the Christians in most parts of the Muslim world at that time. Now, that was called a golden age. Who coined the term and where did it come from? If you're seriously interested in this, I want to recommend a book for you, written by a friend and colleague named Mark Cohen at Princeton. It's called Under Crescent and Cross. And it's a comparative study of the status of Jews in the Christian medieval world and in the Muslim medieval world. And he goes in some detail to support the basic position that I'm giving you today. When the Jews were finally expelled from Spain in 1492, they had a very short period of time to go wherever. And remember, they were expelled from Christian Spain, not from Muslim Spain. The Jews were never expelled from Muslim Spain. There were times of massacres. There were times of persecution. But the Muslims didn't expel the Jews entirely from the peninsula at any time, or even from any particular geographic or governmental holding. When they were expelled and they were looking for places to go, some encouraged the Jews to move to the Ottoman Empire, where they were welcomed with the kind of, again, this kind of second-class status, but a legal status and protection within the empire. And some of the letters that were sent to Jewish communities and relatives who had moved north to Europe, for example, or to Italy, we're saying, this is a golden year. Leave the Christian world. It's not going to get any better for you. Come to the Ottoman Empire where you can live with us and life is much better here. And that's on the record. Some references even to a kind of golden environment or a golden situation. Now, nobody really read those letters 100 or 200 years after they were written. The Jews, some went to Holland, some went to Western Europe, some went to North Africa, some went to further east in the Ottoman Empire, and eventually life went on. In the 19th century, after the emancipation of Jews in Western Europe, Jews in Eastern Europe were suffering, and they were quite aware that their brethren in the West were being welcomed, not entirely, not fully, not totally, but being welcomed more into Western culture and society. And it wasn't happening in the East, where the overwhelming majority of the Jewish population lived. And there were a lot of Jewish intellectuals who were reading histories and intellectually emancipated, but politically not emancipated. And there was some people had rediscovered some of these old letters and manuscripts that were written in Hebrew, and they cited them in order to kind of embarrass the Christian rulers at the time in the East by saying the Ottoman Empire was a golden age. This was a time when the Ottoman Empire was nearly dead. Was considered primitive, and that European culture and economies were growing at a rapid rate, and these people were saying, you know, if we had a golden age under these kind of so-called primitive Muslims, you Christians should get it together and realize, you know, what you're talking about enlightenment. You should, you know, we need to have, be able to have rights like everybody else. And so they're developed within the kind of Jewish world a kind of view that life was good among the Muslims in parts of the medieval world. At the same time, the Zionist movement had begun, and Zionists were trying to bring Jews to Palestine under the Ottomans, and then later under the British, used that narrative, that view, that image, in order to try to get Jews to move to Palestine and not stay in Europe. This was also during the period of pogroms, terrible time for Jews in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century in Eastern Europe. And they said, look, we're going to reestablish this golden age, come to live in the Muslim world and establish the Jewish commonwealth. So it was first an Eastern European Jewish intellectual narrative or statement, golden age under the Muslim world, a way to kind of put the Christian powers to protect the Jews. They think they're enlightened and act enlightened. And then it became part of a Zionist narrative to try to bring Jews into Palestine or colonizing Palestine. Say, don't be afraid of the Muslim world. And then the tensions between the Jewish settlers and the indigenous Arabs living in Palestine, and some of the Arab settlers who came in from the east through an increasing economy, there was a growing conflict between the two communities, and the Jews were saying, well, these guys are causing all our problems. You know, we want to bring industry and economy and education to this primitive part of the world, and the local Arabs are just acting very primitively and violently, and they're opposing. They don't know what's good for them, and they're opposing it. And it's the problem with the tensions between the Jewish colonists and the Arabs is the fault of the Arabs who are here, who are just being obstinate. And the Arabs are saying, well, that's not the problem. The problem is that you are coming in and taking over our economies and buying up all our land and expelling our people from the local lands. And we've always welcomed you. After all, you even said yourself that life is best in the Muslim world. So it's not us. There's nothing inherently problematic with us as Muslims or Arabs, because it was in the Arab Muslim medieval world that you yourself said it was a golden age. So it became a political issue for what would be later called Palestinians, who used it against, to kind of create a position vis-a-vis Zionist settlement in the early part of the 20th century. So that that's how the Golden Age was used politically. Then the Jews were involved in, especially around the time of the, shortly after the establishment of the state, and with the development of this, you know, increasing tension with the war and the use of this Golden Age paradigm among Arab propagandists, the Jews in Israel began to reevaluate that notion of the Golden Age, and they discovered that it wasn't so golden after all. There were massacres of Jews in the Arab world. There were plenty of times in the Arab Muslim world in which the laws of the Dhimma, which is that system for protecting the Jews and Christians but as second-class citizens in the world, that was transgressed, and there were plenty of times when the Jews and Christians were not protected properly in the Muslim world, even according to Islamic law, and it was a terrible problem. So there became a kind of counter propaganda view that there was no golden age in the medieval world. It was all just propaganda by Palestinian nationalists and others who are trying to prevent Jews from being able to establish their rights for a national homeland, the land that they actually own. And so that whole notion of the golden age became a political tool for both sides, one way or another. And that's why we're not really sure if there was one or if there wasn't one, because we've heard these different stories of different versions go around about that golden age. Does anyone have any questions or comments about this? Yes. He's receiving the revelations from God. Clinically, He and Jeremiah and Isaiah might all be put in some institution somewhere. But he knows he is a prophet. And I'm not denigrating Muhammad, okay? I'm saying he and Jeremiah, Isaiah, other people who are in the same category. They know they're a prophet. Not everybody else will accept that. And he's been rejected by his hometown, which is a center for polytheistic religious practice in Arabia. It is a cult center. Many different representations of the powers that run nature and the universe were situated in and around the city of Mecca, and people would come there to worship the various gods and their representations in Mecca. And the Mecca was truly a Mecca for what we would call today the religious tourism industry. Because people would come from all over Arabia, and they would, especially during certain times of the year, the Hajj period, where they would come to make pilgrimage and worship the gods. And when they came to Mecca, they had to stay in a hotel or something, right? Someone had to take care of their camels. There was a hotel industry. When you're in town, after living out in the Arab steppe for a while, you want to get some nice meals, so you go one night you eat Indonesian, another night Indian. So you're going out, and then you need to hire a guide to tell you where to go, to do what kind of ritual at the various locations. Somebody's involved in the guiding services. You need to purchase sacrifices or offerings. Somebody was in that supply business. So there was a big economy in Mecca that was based on this polytheistic practice. Muhammad comes into town. He's born there. And he begins to receive the revelations. And he gathers a group of people around him. And he says, don't worship these. They're nothing. They're not going to do you any good. All they're going to do is cause you trouble, because they don't exist in the first place. And he associated he associated polytheism with immoral or unethical practices, and he preached the notion of a single God in the universe who is a just God, who demands justice, but also is merciful. And if you want to be just, you need to worship the God of justice. And if you worship the God of justice, you must act justly. You need to make sure that the poor people are taken care of, the taxes are distributed equitably, that there is no corruption in government, etc., etc. And you have to stop worshiping these idols that don't help you. They're going to cause you to go, in fact, to hell. And so he, as you can imagine, was persona non grata in the religious tourism industry, which was a very strong lobby in the city of Mecca. There were no Jews or Christians living in Mecca. There were no permanent Jewish or Christian settlements in the city of Mecca, which makes sense. You wouldn't want to have a cathedral in a town where everybody's worshiping idols or Jewish day schools. You wouldn't want to raise your kids there. So there was a Jewish community in the north, in Medina, and there was a Christian community in the south, in a town called Najran. And they went to Mecca for the trading period, when there were trading fairs and things, but they didn't live there. And so Muhammad knew about Jews, knew about Christians, knew about various religious expressions. And when life became extremely precarious for him, because as he alienated more people in his hometown, his life became pretty worthless. And there was a danger that he would be killed by his Meccan tribal compatriots. And so he found refuge in a complicated story, and he ended up in Medina. Medina, remember, was a town in which there was a well-established Jewish community. And Muhammad expected the Jews to accept him, because as opposed to polytheists, who don't know from monotheism and don't understand true prophecy and prophethood, the Jews were understood in Arabia as being an ancient community, a very wise community, and that they knew about prophets and they knew about monotheism. So he expected them to accept him as a prophet. It was almost as if he would go to Medina and he would say, landsman, I'm here. But what he didn't know was what we just learned earlier this afternoon, and that is that all religions call an official stop to prophecy and revelation and cannot accept prophets after the canonization of their scripture. Jewish scripture had been canonized 600 years or so before birth of Muhammad. So when he came to Medina, he was confronted with a community of Jews who said, "You're no prophet," which of course is what we call a logical disconnect. There's a word for it that's slipping.
Cognitive
dissonance. Because he knew he was a prophet, because he was receiving revelations from God, continuing to do so. He was a prophet that continued to receive revelations. But from the Jewish perspective, he wasn't a prophet. He couldn't possibly be a prophet. And from the Jewish perspective, Muhammad proved that he wasn't a prophet. Because the revelations that Muhammad recited in the public square in Medina were revelations that were often recognizable to Jews and Christians because they included biblical characters like Noah or Moses or Jesus or Abraham. But the stories were, and even when they were the same stories, they were different versions of the same stories, a different telling of even the same story. So there are stories about the redemption from Egypt, the destruction of Pharaoh's armies in the Red Sea, the stories of the golden calf, the receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai. It's all there in the Quran, but it's told differently enough so the Jews, when they heard the story, would say, "You don't even have the story correct. You got it wrong. So you can't be a prophet." That reminds me, I have to tell you a little story about my daughter, who's now an adult, but this proves the first telling is the authentic telling of the story. You know that, right? Like, I don't know how many people, you know Adon Olam, the song Adon Olam, a certain tune? Yeah, and there's only one really authentic tune for that. The one you grew up with, right? So, my daughter learned the Cinderella story from a Walt Disney videotape. And then when she was older, she went to middle school, and she learned the Brothers Grimm collection of writing. And she read the Cinderella story, which of course was completely different. And she said, "I can't believe this, Abba." She said, "They're trying to tell me that this is what the Cinderella story is all about?" Because she knew the original story was the video version. Cartoon. So, you know, from the Jewish perspective, the story that we know from Torah and Midrash, certainly Torah, is the authentic story. And the story that this new prophet gives has to be, by definition, has to be wrong. But from the prophet's perspective, who heard the story just the other day from God, you know, the prophet knows that the Jews are wrong. Now, why would the Jews tell me, as a prophet, that I'm wrong? Why would they do that? All I'm doing is trying to respond to the divine will. All I'm doing is trying to get the world to live more ethically. I'm now stepping out of my narrative role to tell you my own personal opinion here. I don't believe for a second that Muhammad was trying to fool anyone. I believe, as a scholar of early Islam, I truly believe deeply that Muhammad believed he was a prophet. He wanted the world to be a better place. He was trying to help the world. I feel the same way about Jesus. Nobody was trying to fool anyone, right? So what would his perspective be about Jews who say you're all wrong? And then maybe some Jew says, "Well, look, here's the story right here. This is how it really goes. And I'll tell you the real version, but that's different from the version I just heard from God. You must be trying to embarrass me in public. You are trying to make a fool out of me. You're telling everybody that I'm not a true prophet. You're undermining me. You're distorting your own version, your own scripture, in order to make me look like a fool." And guess what? The Quran accuses the Jews of distorting their own scripture. So what that is really a reflection of the reality of a historical confrontation, one of those sad confrontations that were inevitable and real, and no one was trying to use a common now American term, screw the other side. I mean, they were, but they weren't doing it because they were being mean. They were doing it because they believed that they were justified. So the Jewish community of Medina and Muhammad and his followers eventually came to arms, one against the other. And it was violent. And the Muslims won. and there were three different Jewish tribes. And you, how many people know this story? Some of you know this story? Okay, there were three different Jewish tribes. The first tribe, in each case, the Jewish tribe, according to Islamic sources, tried to discredit, belittle, or kill Muhammad. In each case, by the way, the Jewish tribes were isolated from one from another. They never supported one another. They fought each other. They didn't support each other when they were being attacked. And there was a kind of divide and conquer. The tribes were eventually beaten. The first two tribes were exiled from Medina. The last tribe, all the men were killed, and the women and children were taken into the Muslim community. The men were beheaded cruelly, and that was the end of the Jewish community in Medina. Now, those are the bare facts. How do we look at the facts? The Jews and Muslims look at conflicts very differently, and they look at them, the conflict, according to their own religious narrative. From the Jewish narrative, I'm going to then deconstruct the Jewish narrative, and I'm going to deconstruct the Muslim narrative. From the Jewish narrative perspective, the Jews were only doing what anybody would do when some prophet tries to take over. And they weren't trying to kill Muhammad. That's not what Jews do. Jews don't act that way. Jews are civilized. So Muhammad and the Muslims simply destroyed the Jewish community gratuitously in order to make a statement, you better not mess with me, and the Jews were innocent. That's not what happened. I can tell you this. I wasn't there. I'm not absolutely certain, but this is what I think happened. The Jews in Medina and the Muslims in Medina were all Arabs. The Jews all had Arab names. They spoke Arabic. They were culturally Arabs. And they were just as violent or non-violent as everybody else in the Arabian Peninsula. They were acting all according to the same cultural rules. They were involved in the same rules of engagement. You may not be aware of this. I'm now jumping a few hundred years earlier. But during the Hellenistic period and the end of the Second Temple period, the Jews were well known all around the region as being very good warriors. They were very tough, mercenary people. They sold themselves out as warriors. There were Jewish regiments as far away as in the Nile, fighting for various governments and armies. The Jews were very tough. Our image of Jewish gentility is an image that was developed in the medieval world when Jews had no power, and no military, no government, and no means to be normal people. But that's not the way Jews were always. You know, do you know about the Jewish Khazar kingdom? There was a Jewish nation between the Black and the Caspian Seas, somewhere around Azerbaijan today, that was a very militant kingdom in the 9th and 10th centuries, from the 8th to the end of that period of time. And they were very tough and very militant. So I think the Jews and the Muslims were playing by the same rules, and the Jews weren't simply being, you know, let's talk about this, let's work it out, and then the Muslims came and killed them all. That's the Jewish narrative. The Muslim narrative is something like this. Muhammad was a just and righteous prophet who never wanted to hurt anybody. He only defended himself, and he wanted to make peace with everyone, and he would always be into compromise, and the Jews were conniving and trying to assassinate the Prophet and simply destroy Islam, and we would never engage in violent behavior under any conditions except only in cases of absolute defense. We would never initiate wars and battles. That's not the meaning of jihad, etc., etc. And it's all the Jews' fault, and we had nothing to do with it. We were forced, essentially, protect ourselves. And that, I'm sure you already know, is not the whole story either. So it's simply a case of two communities. There's a famous Western in American television in which these two gunslingers are in a town, and they say, this town isn't big enough for both of us. So only one person will walk out of here. And that seems to have been the case. Medina wasn't big enough for two expressions of competing monotheisms at that time, and only one walked out. Now, so what do we learn from this story true story. That is, that there was this clash. The last of the three tribes was taken. Oh, by the way, I should mention something else. If you think the Jews don't do this, read chapter 20 of the book of Deuteronomy, and you'll see that the rules of engagement for fighting neighboring nations is, if they fight you, you'll beat them, and when you beat them, kill all the men and take all the women and children as booty. It's in the rules of engagement in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 20, if you want to double check it. So, but what happens is, then the narrative takes over. And the Jewish narrative, here's another piece of ammunition. Muslims are violent, inherently. Their Quran is violent. Their prophet was violent. What do you expect from them? It doesn't matter that Muslims who are living in Europe today might have true grievances. They may, in fact, be victims of prejudice, of racism. They may be economic victims. They may be victims in all kinds of different ways. That has nothing to do with it. The issues are Islam is a problematic religion, right? This is a narrative perspective, a very simplistic narrative perspective. And, the Muslim simplistic narrative perspective would be Jews or Jews and Christians are trying to destroy Islam. Look at the Crusades. Look at the treatment. Look at what the Jews tried to do to the innocent Prophet Muhammad in Medina. And so they're always going to try to undermine us and try to destroy us. What do you expect for Jews in a Jewish state? And so we have to deal with them the way we're dealing with them, and that is there's no solution to the problem. The only solution to the problem is to end the existence of the Jewish state, and that should be the end of it. Now, that's not all Muslims believe that. Not all Arabs believe that, but that's sort of like the radical case of the radical expression of the ultimate narrative, just as I gave the kind of radical case, the ultimate expression of the Jewish narrative vis-a-vis Islam. And you can add certain Christian aspects to Christian narratives that have pieces of these things as well. So I think I probably spent plenty of time talking to you, right? Is now a good time to take that little break? And then we come back together? Okay, so let's take a break now. And then maybe after we come back together, we'll just begin with questions and answers about specifics. Okay? Thank you.